College football is at a crescendo. Championship game, Georgia and TCU. This is a really good matchup. Going to dive into it in the next segment for you. I told you things to look out for in the semifinal games, and those proved to be true. I'm going to do that for you again this week. What to look out for when Georgia and TCU meet for the national championship. Also going to give you some quick thoughts about the NFL playoff picture. You know, way back when the conference championships would be played about this time, it'd be the weekend of the AFC and NFC championship games, even during 16-game regular seasons. And now we're just finishing the regular season. That's how much longer the season is now. And it takes a greater toll on players' bodies. And in the wake of the DeMar Hamlin injury, the guest for this episode will be Upton Bell, who was an executive for the Baltimore Colts and the New England Patriots, and an owner of the World Football League's Charlotte Hornets. His father, Burt Bell, was NFL commissioner. So Upton grew up around pro football. He's been around it his entire life. He's going to give you some perspective, memories, and commentary that you won't hear from anyone else. I'm Jackson Michael. Up next, I'll be digging deep into the college national championship game on the Game Before the Money on the SportsMap Radio Network and the SportsMap Radio app. Visit thegamebeforethemoney.com and check out the Game Before the Money podcast. The college football playoff championship game is set. TCU against Georgia. These teams have played each other only four times in history. Georgia has won all four, including the 2016 Liberty Bowl and the 1942 Orange Bowl. Those games won't affect the outcome of this game. So let's look at some of the things that I will be watching for and hope to give you a way to enjoy this game at a higher level. First of all, both semifinal games ended close and were high scoring. Last week, I mentioned that Michigan-TCU might come down to whether Michigan could prevent TCU from making big plays. Well, TCU got those big plays. I also said that if Georgia didn't hit on all cylinders and get out to a big early lead, that it was likely going to be a very close game with a lot of momentum shifts. And that's exactly what happened. I also mentioned that Ohio State's offensive interior line play was going to be crucial for the Buckeyes, and they played an excellent game, often neutralizing that great Georgia interior defensive line. So here's a couple of things in that game that I want to point out for the upcoming Georgia-TCU game. Against Ohio State, Georgia countered Ohio State's interior offensive line by running a few stunts. They would have a linebacker or defensive back come up the middle and bring pressure up the middle against CJ Stroud. And that proved very effective. The next thing I want to talk about is Ohio State's missed field goal at the end of the game, because this is really going to elevate your ability to watch field goal attempts. The Buckeyes were kicking from the left hash mark. Georgia lined up heavy to the right. A defender broke through on the right-hand side, and there was a defender that started breaking through up the middle. Everybody talks about snap, hold, snap, hold. Yes, those are important elements. But what you also want to watch is the defense. How much pressure are they putting on the kicker, and from where are they bringing it? When you got a guy coming on strong from the right-hand side, the kicker has to compensate for that so it doesn't get blocked. Also, If a guy starts crashing through the middle, that's another thing to compensate for. On top of that, Ohio State was kicking from the left hash mark. So they were already heavy to the left. Then you have to push it a bit to the left because that right-hand side is being contested. It's kind of like a quarterback hurry and the passing lane's being shut down. I really think kicking defense should be a statistic because I wouldn't be surprised if you'd find there are some teams that are forcing a lot more missed field goals than other teams. I didn't recognize that part of the game until Greg Bingham, who played linebacker for the Houston Oilers, explained to me that the Bengals missed a field goal because of safety Vernon Perry coming from the outside, and that forced kicker Chris Barr to push it the other way a little bit to lessen the chance of a blocked kick. Now, when you're watching field goal attempts and you see a missed field goal and you watch for the defensive pressure, you're going to notice that a lot of times those missed field goals happen when a kicker misses to the opposite side from where the pressure is coming. And that's why I'd love to see somebody start keeping track of missed field goals against teams and see which teams seem to be forcing missed field goals. Again, in this case, Ohio State was kicking from the left hash mark. It was a great coaching job by Georgia to bring that heaviest pressure from the right-hand side, forcing that kicker to think more about pushing it to the left, where he already had less room on that side to make it. Pressure also came from up the middle, which made it even tougher. The second thing I really want to point out from that Georgia-Ohio State game is the late pass rush that Georgia got. If you're able to create pass rush late in the game, that's an enormous advantage. The 1980s San Francisco 49ers and often the 1980s Denver Broncos are two teams that seemed to do that often during close games. Both of those teams made a lot of Super Bowls. Georgia did that against Ohio State on the last drive. They almost came close to sacking Stroud out of field goal range. So looking ahead to TCU and Georgia now, what am I looking for? What do I think is going to happen? I look at this matchup and I see TCU as being somewhat similar to Ohio State. Similar quarterbacks, they got playmaking receivers, and TCU really has an even more explosive offense in terms of big playability. I don't think their offensive line is as good as Ohio State's, but they are experienced, and I think they could be equally effective against Georgia. Georgia is the defending champion, and experience means a lot in these games, not only for players, but for coaches as well. To me, the Bulldogs have looked like the best overall team this year. In this game, I think it's again down to whether Georgia builds a big lead by halftime. Their experience opens up that possibility, in my opinion. I think there's a small chance for that to happen. If that doesn't happen, here are the factors that I think will determine this game. One is turnovers. TCU has a secondary that produces interceptions, and they even had two pick sixes against Michigan, and a couple of games before that, they had two pick sixes against Iowa State. Georgia is now -2 for turnovers this season. TCU is +9, and I think this secondary against Stetson Bennett, who has 7 interceptions this season, I think that's a real TCU strength against a Georgia vulnerability. On the other hand, Georgia has a couple of receiving weapons, Brock Bowers at tight end and Kenny McIntosh out of the backfield that could really cause some big problems. TCU has to contain both of those guys because I think this matchup creates a potential for either one of them, Bowers or McIntosh, to be game breakers and have a really big game. Thirdly, And I think this is big. If it's a close game at the end, TCU's clock management is nowhere near Georgia's. TCU had a 13-point lead against Michigan late, and the Horned Frogs had already used two of their second half timeouts. Then they used their third before a kickoff. If this game comes down to which team manages the clock better late in the game, and in close games, it often comes down to that. Georgia, I think, has a real advantage there. And the Michigan game isn't the only game that I thought TCU made some poor decisions late in the game. I thought the same thing happened in the Big 12 championship game where they lost to Kansas State. Overall, I think this championship game has a very good chance of turning out similar to the semifinal games, although I have a hunch it might be a bit lower scoring. It's just a hunch. TCU's defense, I think, has a good chance of forcing Bennett into making mistakes. I also think that Georgia's experience and better clock management might make the difference. And similar to the semifinal game, the question is, can Georgia limit TCU's big plays? And how will TCU's offensive line do against that Georgia interior defense? I give a slight advantage to Georgia in this game. Combination of depth, experience, and having both Bowers and McIntosh. But that playmaking secondary and those explosive playmakers on TCU's offense, I think, creates a real opportunity for TCU to win. I'm excited about this game. It should be really fun to watch. I'm Jackson Michael. This is the Game Before the Money. Visit thegamebeforethemoney.com. Coming up, some great insight from former Colts and Patriots executive Upton Bell. Upton Bell joining the show now. His father, Burt Bell, founded the Philadelphia Eagles and later was NFL commissioner in the mid-1940s through the 1950s. Upton was an executive for the Baltimore Colts through the 1960s and into the 1970s, including for the Colts teams that played in Super Bowl III and in Super Bowl V. He later became general manager of the New England Patriots and owner of the World Football League's Charlotte Hornets. Obviously, DeMar Hamlin's injury has dominated the news. Upton's here to give you some real insight and perspective based on what he's seen through his lifetime of experience. Here's Upton Bell.
Upton, you were in attendance when Daryl Stingley was paralyzed with a hit from Jack Tatum. I believe that was a preseason game even.
No, it was, and I was not in attendance. We did the game on WBC on television, and I had just finished with Bob Lobel, my talk show, leading into the game. Now, a little background. I knew John Madden for years. First met him when I was scouting, and he was the assistant coach of San Diego State under Don Coryell. And so he and I we were both really young together, and he was starting out with Al Davis. You know, went from there to San Diego and then to the Raiders. And so I always thought to myself, and even afterwards, I like Madden a lot, but back to that game, I remember, and not only the replays, the hit. And I said, oh my God. The minute I saw the hit, I said, he'll never get up. Never get up. And Jack Tatum, who I had scouted in college, I always knew was a cheap shot artist. And the irony to me, not only of that night, but the rest of the time, is that you would really like John Madden. Of course, the whole country loved him, when he particularly went to television. But what part of him, because there was always a warning when you played the Raiders, watch yourself. Catch the ball. Watch out. Watch out for cheap shot. And I always thought to myself, Madden, on one hand, is kind of a clean guy, pretty good guy, big, jolly guy, very, very smart. And yet his teams were really dangerous to play against them. If you remember, too, and maybe your audience doesn't, the very famous quote by Chuck Nolan, who I'd worked with the Steelers, when he said, talking about the Raiders, there's a criminal element in football, and accused the Raiders that it ended up being a court case, a very famous one at the time. So at that time, looking at that shot on Darryl Stingley, of course, he never walked again, had a very tragic life. I got a hold of Madden 2 days later, came on, was wonderful. He actually went to the hospital, which is kind of unusual. And maybe he went to the hospital, too, feeling very guilty because he knew what Tatum was and Atkinson and all of that, Phil Villapiano. But that was football then. People could get away with certain things. Those Raider teams would never get away today with what they got away with then. But it was horrible. The sight was horrible. And I look at that where you could clearly see what happened. And I look at this, even though they have now covered over it, and saw him get up and then saw him fall down. I said, when I first saw it, I said, he's dead. And, you know, somebody walks that way, gets up, and then just goes down. I said, I think he's dead. That was my reaction. So each time along the way, the NFL, for all of its glory, for all of its successes, and I'm happy for them, basically is a very violent game, maybe the most violent of them all. And I keep saying to people, it's not hitting, it is a collision sport. It is a car accident every time the ball is snapped. And every time that happens, the chances of injury are great. In the early years that I was with the Colts, I was the same age as many of the players. So I used to go out and have drinks with them. And we would discuss, you know, the game itself. But all of them said the same thing, that their greatest worry is that they were, and remember in those days they didn't make a lot of money, Michael. Their great worry was, and most of them were married, was they were one blow away from their career ending. They didn't talk about their life ending, but to them, they had that great fear always in the back of their mind. If you're going to play football on any level, but particularly on the pro level, you must deal with the idea that when you go out on that field that day, you might not end up the same way in the end. Think about how to be able to put your mind at rest, knowing that you're going out, could break your leg, you could have a concussion. I've never known a player that wasn't injured. Never. To some degree. So it's a great American sport, but on the other hand, for the people who play it, it ain't so great.
I think you brought up something that's really important to talk about, because when we're watching this stuff and we're sitting on our couch and everything, there comes to, I think, in our minds that these guys are bigger, tougher, stronger. There's something about them that makes them almost immune to the injuries that we would suffer if we went out onto the field. You know, I wouldn't fare as well on the field. I'd be knocked out on the first play, but they're at the same risk factor.
They are at the same risk factor. And again, it's a collision. It's a car crash on every play. I would tell people, because in the early years that I used to work on the field during the game, if you heard, I mean, with all of the advances in television, and you can occasionally hear a curse word or hear the actual banging of players against each other, if you were on the field during a game and heard the sound of it, the grunts, the groans, the, you know, the basically when two guys hit each other, it's deafening. You know, you would say to yourself, except for the cannons, let's say, in old wars fought, you would say, is this any different than war? You know, people don't die, but it's like two lines clashing. The noise of it is really amazing. And I don't say that because it's something great. I'm just saying, I finally got used to the sound of it and the conversations of it. and what people say to each other. Let me give you an example, let's say in training camp. 1966 training camp, second year, Mike Curtis. I drafted him in the first round in 1965. I convinced Shule, I said, you really have to make him a linebacker. I said, he's not a running back in this league. So anyway, the opening of training camp, they have a thing that's now either outlawed now or they just don't do it. It's called the Oklahoma drill. And some people called it the Nutcracker drill. And basically what you would do is you would have two tackling dummies separated by maybe 2 or 3 yards. And you'd have the quarterback, a running back, an offensive lineman or a tight end on one side. On the other side, you have one defender, whether it's a defensive lineman or a linebacker. And you have to run straight ahead. The object was the offensive lineman would be trying to, you know, bury or defeat the defensive lineman or linebacker. And they, on the other hand, on the other side, would try to stand the person up and make the tackle. I mean, it was truly hand-to-hand combat. So that first day, John Mackey was lined up as a tight end. And on the other side was Mike Curtis. I remember saying to Shule, I said, you know, Mackey to me still to this day was one of the most devastating blockers of tight end. Forget it, even a receiver. And, of course, now he's in the Hall of Fame. I said, I think Mike Curtis, even though he weighs less than Mackey, will have a good chance of standing him up. If you could stand the person up, get underneath him, and make the play, then you were considered, you know, it was break even. Snap the ball, Mackey comes off, and it ends up that Curtis was able to tie him up. And I said to myself from that day on, I said, Curtis is going to be a great linebacker. And here's the rest of the story. Both those guys died from CTE. That's the story. And John Mackey, who was as handsome, I said to John, you're going to Hollywood. He was head of the Players Association. He was handsome, articulate, everything. I mean, within years after he retired, he didn't know who the hell he was. And in the case of Mike Curtis, of course, I talked to him just, you know, a month or so before he died. There's a guy that made a lot of money in real estate, had a wonderful life, and then all of a sudden it was gone. He didn't know who the hell he was. He ended up in a home. And I said, two memories that day of those two great players in the Oklahoma drill, and then years later, not knowing who they are and having a terrible, terrible life and dying. Horrible.
This is the Game Before the Money. Visit thegamebeforethemoney.com. Coming up, more with Upton Bell. Back with former Colts and Patriots executive Upton Bell, sharing his thoughts and insight and a perspective that only he can provide.
Upton, your dad canceled a game in the 1930s, correct?
1935, yes.
And what was the reasoning behind that?
They would never go for it today. It was snowing and raining. The game was in Philadelphia. I think, Michael, it was the Brooklyn Dodgers then that had a football team that the reason they canceled. I have to remember one other thing in those days that you could never get away with again today. If you had no tickets sold, there were owners that tried to find a way out because you had no TV money. You had nothing to support you. And therefore, to open up the gates and play the game, you would lose a small fortune.
Yeah, and that wasn't too uncommon in the earliest days of the NFL in the 1920s, I think, to cancel games.
It wasn't, but they kept repeating it last night on television all the time, and I kept saying, I know the game, I know it was my father, and, you know, a completely different time. But think about it, to go all that time till the other night. And by the way, the minute I saw the player go down and saw what briefly was happening, my first tweet out was, call the game, Roger Goodell. Burt Bell would call the game. And the reason he would, and here's the big difference, Burt Bell was the only commissioner in NFL history who actually played the game on a high college level. He was a player first, a coach second, an owner third, and commissioner fourth. But he knew when things had to be called off. Now, you and I have done before the famous 1948 game when the Cardinals the day before had taken a vote not to play, and my father called them and told them, you're going to play the game, because I've sold it for national television. But that's the only other time. And people, you know, all around yesterday were trying to figure out, well, when was the last time they called a game? That was it, 1935.
Yeah, and under very different circumstances than the game with the Bills and Bengals, and of course the very serious injury that DeMar Hamlin suffered. Is there other points in time that you can remember such a serious injury happening?
No. In fact, I was saying for 73 years, I've seen everything in the NFL, mostly firsthand, but never anything like that. And let me tell you for the first time today why I immediately infected everybody who watched it. I mean, it's still today on CNN and national TV, that's all they're talking about. But in this case, when we find out that he really was, he basically was dead on the field, was dying. And it took me back to something. And this is why, Michael, I say this to you today, that I would not be surprised. I don't think it's happened. But I wouldn't be surprised if the Buffalo Bill players voted not to play this Sunday. I'm not talking about the game, replaying the Cincinnati-Buffalo game. I'm saying you never know. I've been in locker rooms my whole life. You never know what players are really thinking. You might think that they're up to play a game and they go out and lay an egg. And then there are other times, I remember being in the Colt locker room, or in the team that I own, the Charlotte Hornets, and saying, they're going to go out and kick some, and they do. So there's no way to tell with something like this. And let me put it on a personal level. In 1959, October the 11th, a day I'll never forget, my father basically dropped dead in front of me. From that day to the day I'm talking to you today, I think of it every day. I've never forgotten it. I would have to say I've never gotten over it. I've gone on with my life. But that was such a shock. And when something like that happens, if it's expected, if somebody's going to die like Pele, you know, they've been watching for weeks and there's a great outpouring and mourning of this great soccer player. But when you see something, bang, bang, and we know what football is, bang, bang, the guy's down. But when you see a person lying on the ground getting CPR, you'll never forget that. I would say my part, my father died. He is still alive, and hopefully God, he will make it. But those players saw that. And when you see something like that, you never forget it. I'm just saying, beware of how players think when they see something like that, because it reminded them, and it always does me, of our mortality. And when it happened suddenly like that, I just wonder. I knew right away that those players and coaches were not going to play that game. I think the NFL, no matter what way they want to slice it, when they said you got 5 minutes, that's the NFL. And later on, they denied it. But I can tell you this, the NFL's mentality is, and I understand, I don't agree with it, the game must go on. I mean, the game went on back when Chuck Hughes dropped dead, but that was a different situation. And I'm not making any excuses about it, but I'm just saying that there's no question in my mind, and I won't belabor it, that the NFL, if the players were okay, would have gone on with that game.
Right, and you brought up Chuck Hughes, and that was in the early 1970s, I think 1971, and he suffered heart failure on the field after running a post pattern. Somewhat right. Similar, although it was at the end of the game. So that was a different circumstance. But what do you remember about that? I guess you were general manager of the Patriots at that time. What do you remember?
I do remember because ironically, you know, there had been other people going back to 1947. I had just come from the Cardinals camp. And I got to know Sam Walden. I got to know him, really liked him a lot, like Charlie Trippi. And I remember being home and my father telling me that he had dropped dead. He had a heart attack. And how terrible I felt. Because as a young boy, you really attach yourself. I've been around players my whole life. Again, it's repetitive, but I have been. And how terrible I felt about that. But in Hughes' case, you're right, it was near the end of the game. And remember something. That day, it was Detroit and the audience around Detroit on television. Everybody saw this on national TV. Even people, I was talking to a doctor yesterday, who I know doesn't watch football, can't stand it. And yet he spent about 20 minutes talking to me about what happened to his heart and how terrible it was and how terrible football was and this and that. I mean, this was the biggest audience you'll ever watch to a degree, maybe other than the Super Bowl, because the two teams playing were two of the best teams, maybe the two best teams in pro football. So the Hughes thing was, compared to today, still terrible because he died. Is kind of a blip on the screen to people who around the country saw this, and people that just tuned in as a curiosity factor, not particularly pro football fans. A lot of people I talked to around Cambridge who are not football fans said, oh yeah, I saw that. Oh my God, how horrible that is. So circumstances different. Hughes died. So far, this poor player has not died, and hopefully he won't. They'll make it through. But I guarantee you, Monday night will be remembered forever in the NFL and to fans.
Yeah, and like you said, it was on a much bigger stage than Chuck Hughes' death. The media now covers everything so much more. In the early 70s, so the coverage of it and the knowledge of it, of Chuck Hughes' death, was nowhere compared to the injury DeMar Hamlin suffered in today's media environment.
Correct. And again, I remember seeing shots of it later on, but it was kind of almost like newsreel when you see it and the way it was reported. Now, everything that you do in the NFL or any sport, you cover them all, is out there all the time. And the other thing that is both good but bad too, this is being repeated like on a reel, repeated hour after hour after hour. And again, now people are speculating. And that's the other thing that happened. that was really interesting. And you got a different look at football players. Tell me the last time, and I call it now every Sunday the card-off section. Guys being carted off for many different things. People staggering around. People with concussions. My worry is that people are getting used to this. You know, see, not this particular situation, but getting used to seeing people stagger around, can't get up, head injuries, leg injuries, you name it. I mean, name it. Through this year, you know, they had an ambulance come right after one of the kickoffs, I believe. An ambulance in the stadium here in Foxborough was silent for like 20, 30 minutes. And again, the scene, one of the parents, I think it was a father in this case, came running down to the stands and they put him in the ambulance and he went away with his son. This is becoming too regular. And I'm not here again to say, oh my God, football's so bad, maybe we should ban it, which will never happen. Maybe it should be touch football or this or that. I'm not saying any of that, but what I'm saying is when the general public sees something like Monday night, and now the drama that's playing out with the Bills, with the Bengals, will they play, won't they play? But more importantly, the reports from the hospital. People are still in those locker rooms, particularly in the Bills' locker rooms. I guarantee you, they're replaying that scene until they know that he is out of real danger. And that could go right through. And talking to some of the doctors, they say it could be days, you know, that while he is sedated and, you know, essentially put to sleep, you might not know for a while. So think about this. Let's say in the worst scenario, he doesn't make it, and now it's the day before the game. And that's why I say to people who say, well, okay, the Patriots are going to be playing there Sunday. I said, don't count on anything right now. Nothing.
That was former Colts and Patriots executive Upton Bell on The Game Before the Money. Check out thegamebeforethemoney.com. A quick look at the NFL playoff picture. The final spot in the NFC comes down to the Packers, Lions, and Seahawks. If the Packers win, then they're in. Despite having a stretch of losing 7 out of 8 games this year. In the AFC, there's a chance that a team with a losing record gets in as a wild card. This is what happens when you have 7 teams per conference make the playoffs. The Patriots are in the playoffs if they defeat Buffalo on Sunday. Otherwise, the Dolphins, who have lost 5 games in a row, have a chance to get in with a win over the Jets, who have also lost 5 games in a row. Now, if Aaron Rodgers and Bill Belichick find a way to get into the postseason, then I would say be very careful about what you think the Patriots and Packers' chances are. I mentioned this about Tom Brady in a previous episode. Those guys know how to win playoff games. They understand that the regular season doesn't matter anymore. Everybody's 0-0 when the playoffs start. You only have to win 3 straight games to make it to the Super Bowl after you make it to the playoffs. If you don't think any of those 3 guys aren't capable of winning 3 straight games, then be my guest and count them out. Me personally, I'm not counting out Aaron Rodgers, Tom Brady, or Bill Belichick until they actually lose and are sitting at home on the sofa watching the playoffs like the rest of us. Thanks for listening to this episode of The Game Before the Money, airing Saturday mornings at 11 a.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. Central on the SportsMap Radio Network. Visit thegamebeforethemoney.com and check out the Game Before the Money podcast.